Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. One of the great challenges in the United States is growing financial insecurity. Extreme wealth inequality has a very high human cost. Two women are on a mission to end poverty in the United States. They just published a book called Broken America: Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. Joanne Goldblum is CEO and founder of the National Diaper Bank Network, with over 200 member organizations that provide diapers and other basic needs to families in America. Colleen Chaddix is a career journalist who has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many more outlets. Colleen left daily newspapers when an editor reprimanded her for writing too many stories about poor people. Joanne Goldblum and Colleen Chaddix, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you.
I appreciate your book, and I think it's a real contribution to the debate about growing financial insecurity. And I'm really looking forward to talking with you about it. And I think you have many wise comments in your book. One of them is you say, as a society, we won't take action to address financial insecurity until we care, which I believe is really true. What motivated you to care more about the poor? And I want both of you to answer.
Okay, I'll start. It's really a lifelong thing. A tough job. At night, her feet would hurt like crazy, and she would soak them in Epsom salts. And one night, some blisters and calluses cracked, and the basin filled with blood. And I was playing at her feet on the floor. And I remember looking at that and thinking, well, people must not know how hard her life is, or they would help her. And when I grow up, I'm going to write stories about people like Mom so that everyone will know. And that's pretty much exactly what Joanne and I did.
And, sure and did. It's interesting because Colleen and I really come to this from very different backgrounds. And I have to always say I've never experienced poverty. But I did grow up in a home where it was very important that we are not sort of in the world alone, and that, you know, I became a social worker. And as a social worker, I saw over and over again a level of poverty that just, even as somebody who thought that they understood what poverty in America looked like, I found that I really didn't. And as somebody who's never struggled with poverty, I always feel like it's really important to say that, you know, when my kids were young, I was always struck by how difficult it was to parent, right? How difficult life is when your kids are young. There's lots of things going on. Everybody's working. Everybody's got to be in different places. And I would think about how very difficult it was for me. And I had everything. We had cars, we had enough money, my husband is great and really helpful, you know, all those things. Mm-hmm. And I was working with families where they didn't have those things, but the same expectations were there. Yet as a middle-class woman, I could complain endlessly about how stressful my life was. And people would, you know, really be nice about it. Whereas, you know, when people who didn't have any money and didn't have enough food to feed their kids complained, people would say, well, you know, you just got to work harder, you know, and there's just this disconnect that is so extreme. And, you know, when Colleen and I met, it was kismet, and we really, you know, we really sort of marry our, both of our experiences.
And I think it's a really fruitful partnership. I'm so glad the two of you teamed up to write this book, Broken America. And, you know, in doing the research for the book, you spoke with a lot of poor people, which I thought was really good. I mean, I read a lot of economic data, but you went to the people and actually talked to the people. And you tell a lot of the stories of the people, and you say, you know, well, there's this myth about poor people being lazy, not working. And yet your experience was of tremendous resilience and hopefulness in the face of incredible obstacles. So I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners one story that you think you found out from doing your research that you think really humanizes the issue of living with very, very little money. And Colleen, we'll start with you.
Okay. There are so many. Mm-hmm. But one that really jumps out at me, we spent some time in Lytle, Texas, which is a very poor community, looking at the impact of going to school in a high poverty district. And, you know, we all have this myth about this one kid who buckles down and studies hard and works hard and makes it out. I spoke with two young men there who were outstanding students and had both gotten free rides to colleges, to very good colleges. Neither of them were going. One was not going because he felt he had a lot of family responsibilities that he needed to take care of, which is not at all unusual for children in poverty. They tend to have adult responsibilities really early. He felt responsible for his mom and his younger brother, and he was probably going to go to a community college so that he could stay at home. The other young man got his full ride taken away because his dad was being audited. His dad was a waiter. What his tax obligation was, I can't imagine. It was very much. It certainly cost us more to audit the guy than we ever would have gotten back. Mm-hmm. He had made an honest mistake on his taxes, but that held up this young man's financial aid. So he could not go to college. This was a kid who studied hard, who lettered in a couple of sports, who worked hard on the weekends. He was doing absolutely everything right. And both those stories to me really undermine this idea that, well, stay in school, son, study hard. You know, this is the American dream. You can make it out. I don't know what those two young men could have done any better than what they were doing.
That's a powerful story. And I think what you're mentioning there around the auditing, it's something that really strikes me. So much of our policies and the way they're implemented are actually kind of crazy. It's all tilted to the very wealthy already. For example, the IRS should be investigating the top 10% of people right. who have most of the wealth in the country. Right. And yet they don't. They're spending a lot of resources. As you say, they probably spend more money investigating this gentleman than they would get out of him, even if they uncovered whatever the issue was. But we're not doing the sensible thing in terms of tax revenue, looking at who's got the most money and where might there be some shavings there. And it hurts. It's just one of the very many ways that people without resources end up having more scrutiny and more trouble than even average middle-class people, much less the wealthy. So thank you for sharing that story. And Joanne, what about you? What was there a particular story that stands out that helped you kind of feel like it really humanized poverty for you?
Yeah. So I think that for me, the water chapter was really, really powerful. You know, speaking to hearing from so many people who, you know, in the United States of America didn't have running water, right? You know, there were a few stories, but the one that really has stuck with me is we spoke with some people in Alaska, in a very rural area of Alaska. Nobody had indoor plumbing, and they described in great detail what was required, what they had to do with the human waste. And it required them putting the solids into a sort of a bag of sorts and carrying it to the town, to an area of the town where they were meant to leave it. And one woman described that she and her friends couldn't let their kids play outside in the spring during the thaw because there was so much human waste in the street. And that's America. This is the United States of America. And we have places where kids can't play outside because of sewage issues. And to me, that was, I had seen a lot of stuff that I really couldn't believe, but that was just outside of what I could have imagined. And there was another man in that chapter who described to us that he spent $20 a week on bottled water to flush his toilet. So we're talking about the most basic needs, right? Mm-hmm. People, you know, we spend so much time and money talking about water in developing countries, as well we should. But people don't talk very much about the fact that we have many of the same issues here.
So true. And, you know, I was reading your book. I was remembering Robert F. Kennedy when he was running for president, and he went around the country and he went through Appalachia, and just how stunned he was at how people live in the United States. And it's just, of course, he came from a multimillionaire, very wealthy family in Massachusetts, but still how stunning it is what a lot of people are dealing with. And you think this is more like a third world country, not the United States. So we've made actually some good gains around poverty since the 1960s, but we haven't by any means eliminated. And I think we're now falling backwards between the 2008 Great Recession, where hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth got, you know, transferred up the chain to the top 1%. And also the pandemic now is aggravating it. So we're losing the gains we had. But so Joanne, when you were working as a social worker, you identified a particular need that really surprised you, but it was something you could do something about. So could you share with our listeners what you discovered and what you did about it?
Sure. So I was, as I said, I was working at Yale Child Study Center doing what we call community-based social work. So I went to people's homes or met with them in the community, wherever they were. And what they had in common, so people, you know, there were substance use issues, there were mental health issues, there were a variety of different things. But what they all had in common was a level of poverty that was unacceptable and unbelievable. In New Haven, Connecticut, right? One of the richest states in the country. And I would drive a mile from my home and be at someone's house who didn't have heat and hot water. And there was one family in particular that I worked with, a mom who was developmentally disabled, and she had three children under three, and they never had toilet paper. And I remember, sort of talking to my supervisor about it and thinking about it clinically. And basically, what my work has become since then is there's not a clinical intervention for not having toilet paper. There's not a clinical intervention if you don't have a diaper to diaper your child. Yes, as a clinician, I can help parents learn certain parenting techniques and things that are important about child development. But every mom I worked with knew when their baby's diaper needed to be changed and felt horribly that they couldn't change it because it really brought into question who they were as a parent. And so, you know, I became really myopic about it and started just to think about, well, why is there no state or federal subsidy for diapers, for period products, for cleaning supplies and paper goods? And it was really, really interesting because I found a couple of things. First, I found out that most of our elected and appointed officials did not know that. Everybody sort of, policymakers tend to think on a very big picture, right? Because that's their job. So, you know, yes, we talk about housing, we talk about food, but we don't talk about the things that you need to get out of the house in the morning. Because that's what most of us spend more of our time thinking about, right? Is, did I brush my teeth? Did I brush my hair? Do I look okay, right? And all of these products that you need to make yourself acceptable in polite society require you to be clean, require you to smell good, require, you know, all of these things. So I started a diaper bank in New Haven, which was at the time the New Haven Diaper Bank and is now the Diaper Bank of Connecticut. And we started giving out diapers. And, you know, I always knew from the beginning that the end goal was to change policy. The stopgap is giving people what they need. And I felt like it was very, very important to do both of those things, because what I think is that so much of American policy doesn't look at those things in tandem. It looks at giving people things as one thing and changing the way policy works as something different. So I really wanted to come at this from the same direction.
That's great. And what years were you in New Haven, by the way?
Well, I'm actually in Brantford now, but we've been in the New Haven area since 1996.
Oh, that's good. I was one of the first women who went to Yale. I was just wondering if we might have crossed paths there.
What year were you here?
I can't even say.
Okay.
Early on. So the stories you're talking about, these are not just a few isolated people. We have like a widespread problem here of, I call it more broadly, economic insecurity. And from the data that I've seen, I believe that it's like about 90% of people in the United States are economically insecure. And obviously it's far worse for the bottom half and the most poor, but that people are really struggling. And unless you're in the top 10%, you're struggling about paying the rent, paying the mortgage, getting your child to college or trade school, having enough for your retirement. The lack of money that people have for retiring is totally scary. So I want you to talk a little bit about like how widespread you see this economic insecurity. What do you see?
Well, it's very widespread. You know, the first section of the book, we went through basic needs like water and hygiene and transportation. And for all of those, there is a federal guideline of how much of your income you should spend on them. And in most of them, half or more of Americans are spending too much, right? So maybe you are not living in visible poverty, but you're spending 60% of your income on housing. That's not sustainable. And that means that you're not saving anything. One of the things we really saw during the pandemic was a lot of people just didn't have the resources to weather being out of work for an extended period of time. And at the same time, billionaire wealth went up $1.1 trillion. you know, worker wages have been flat since the 1970s, and cost of living hasn't been flat. In that period, healthcare has gone up just over 100%. So the gap between what people have and what they need, which is what we define as poverty, it's very real for many of us. And many of us are just sort of squeaking by, but there's no margin for error.
Exactly right. And, you know, we've got the Federal Reserve, even before the pandemic, saying that 40% of Americans did not have $400 to cover an unexpected expense. Right. And you say in your book, nearly 70% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. And that was before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say, because I think sometimes we think about economic insecurity and we think, oh, well, maybe that's like 10% of the population. But we're talking now, I believe, it's the norm in the United States to be seriously insecure economically. It's the norm. And I'm a little concerned as we try to get support for various programs, if we talk about the poor, it just triggers all these images and myths in people's mind. And that particularly now people's reaction can be, hey, I'm really struggling myself. I need to take care of me. And I can't worry about the poor people, particularly now. I think the right-wing Republicans have done quite a job on convincing people that the poor are, you know, they're black and lazy. They could work, but they don't. If you give them money, they'll spend it on drink and drug. You know, this whole mythology around poverty. And I think when we talk about economic insecurity, to do it in ways where more people could feel like, hey, they're going to give me a hand up too. It's not just for, you know, the undeserving poor. What do you think about that?
So, you know, I think that that's really the thesis of our book, is that, you know, as Americans, we are so committed to the idea of, you know, anybody can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, that anybody who works hard enough can get ahead. And first off, it's just not true. You know, the stories Colleen told us about the two young men in Texas, they did everything they were supposed to. And there are endless stories like that. But, you know, we always go back to the idea that there's that old adage, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him to fish, he fishes for a lifetime, he eats for a lifetime. We say, okay, but what if there's no water? What if he doesn't have a fishing pole? You know, that this idea that not giving people things somehow makes them stronger, as opposed to listening to the Snickers ad that says, you're not yourself when you're hungry. You know, when it comes to candy, we're willing to sort of say that that's true. But when it comes to children going to school, we think that somehow giving people breakfast and lunch is creating laziness. Whereas, you know, you can't learn if you don't have breakfast and lunch. And a child's job is to learn. And we should support that. So I just, you know, we just really believe that attitude that you talked about is really so detrimental. And it's a big part of the reason we wrote the book, because we wanted to say, just because you don't think you see poverty doesn't mean it doesn't exist in your community.
And another big part of it is, you know, the Reverend William Barber always says that poverty and racism are interlocking evils. When things interlock, they make each other stronger. And the disdain for the poor that we have in this country, mm-hmm. I think, is largely tied up with racism. And we have to find ways to get past that. You know, in Finland, people don't tell stories about welfare queens, right? Because most people in Finland look alike. And it's easier in a country like that for people to say, hey, I've got a common cause with this person. I want to make sure this person has health care and housing and everything else they need. Americans need to get there. We really need to get there. It's the 21st century. It's ridiculous that the most wealthy nation in human history allows 1 in 5 of its children to grow up in poverty. And we have to do some soul searching to get better than we are.
And I guess I just want to add to that also, you know, you started the question with people think of poverty, they think of a black face or a brown face. But what we say in our book, and it's true, is the face of poverty in the United States is a white face. And in reality, it is a white child's face. That is the largest population of poor people in the country.
Yeah, I was so glad you mentioned that in your book. It's stunning. People don't believe me when I tell them, but most poor people are white. Most poor people are white. And when you have 1 in 5 children in poverty, poor people, a lot of the poor children people are children. So, and you say if you were to think of a face of poverty in America today, it would be the face of a white child. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. And I love the work that Marion Wright Edelman has done in the Children's Defense Fund. And she's kind of worked around, you know, how do we eliminate child poverty? I want to circle back to that in just a little bit, because there's some exciting new things happening around eliminating child poverty. But I just wanted to underscore something you said, Joanne, about, you know, people can't fish if they don't have a pole, they don't have access to water, if there aren't fish in the stream. There's a lot of reasons why teaching a person to fish isn't going to help them. I was thinking as you said that, the mindset is if you want a wealthy person to work, you pay them more. You know, you motivate them by paying them more. If you want a poor person to work, you pay them less. I mean, it's just like, no, not really. But we have, they're calling it the K, I don't know if this comes across, the K recovery out of this right. pandemic recession, where some people are keeping going down. That's the bottom part. But then you mentioned the billionaires, they're like unbelievable jump up in the wealth of the very, very wealthy already. So it's an extremely unstable situation. And to me, it's kind of like, and the more you know about policy, the more true it is. It's like there's this vacuum cleaner sucking the resources up to the top 1%. And it's staggering that the top 1% has more wealth than 90% of the rest of us combined. So
and I think the thing that's so important about that is that it's the way our system is set up. They are not doing anything that is against the rules. They are following the rules that we have established. And the rules we've established is that if you have wealth, it is easier to grow your wealth than if you don't have anything. And I think that that is such an important part of why we wanted to write this book, because I don't want to villainize the rich any more than I want to villainize the poor, mostly, you know, don't really want to. You know, the fact is that most of us do what we can, right? And so if the rules say you can shelter all of your money without paying taxes, that's what people are going to do. Mm-hmm. So we have to change the rules.
I totally agree. And actually, I know quite a few very wealthy people, including billionaires, and not a single one of them wants to think that they got their wealth by pushing other people down or taking anything from anybody. They actually believe that they got it because they're smart and they worked hard. And every wealthy person I know likes to help other people succeed also. None of them are like, oh, I want more and more myself. It's like, oh, this is great. And I want other people to succeed as well. So I agree with you. It's not about villainizing wealthy people at all. I actually want everybody to be wealthy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I think it's almost a case of making our policies match our myths.
Right.
We all are told that if we work hard and we do the right thing, we will get ahead. And as we saw illustrated in the lives of so many people, that's not true. Mm-hmm. It should be possible to get ahead by working hard. Both exactly. of those young men should be going to college. People shouldn't need to work three jobs to pay their rent. Going to work, working your hard 8 hours or maybe a little bit more should be enough to support your family. And it's not. Something's fundamentally broken and has been getting increasingly broken for decades.
Exactly right. And that is, to his credit, one of the great things that President Bill Clinton did when he was in office was put in the earned income tax credit. So when he discovered that people were working full time and yet were still poor, he said, that is just wrong. That is like not American. And he put in the earned income tax credit. So you file for your taxes, even if you don't owe any taxes because you made so little, you would actually get payment from the government. And I love that program. I think it's like rewarding work. And I love that framing of matching the policy to the myth. And to me, that's part of what the earned income tax credit is mm-hmm. putting policy to the myth. If you work hard, you can succeed. And we need to really make that possible. Let's talk a little bit about other solutions. And we obviously have had now 50 years or 60 years of efforts to address poverty seriously, sparked in part by the book, The Other America, by Michael Harrington. And from that came the war on poverty. And so we've had some good success. And it's important for people to know we have done things that have worked, like the earned income tax credit has worked. One of the other things is food, like the idea of anyone hungry in the great United States of America is just shocking. And there's been efforts on that. We have the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which quite a number of people access. But you talk in your book that there's a lot of people who qualify for SNAP, for example, but they don't access the program. Like, what are the obstacles to accessing food if you need it?
So there are a few different obstacles. You know, I think the biggest obstacle is the complications we put in to applying for public benefits. So, you know, you can apply for a mortgage online or buy a car that can be delivered to your house, but applying for SNAP, you know, food stamps, what most people call it, is an incredibly complicated process that requires huge amounts of documentation. And one of the things that we know, both from researching the book and that, you know, I know from my work as a social worker, is that one of the sort of basic needs that people don't talk about is information, maintaining your personal information. You know, when I can't find one of my kids' birth certificates, I can get another copy. But there's an expense to that. There's time, you know, in some places you actually have to go to City Hall and get it, you know, so there's transportation. There are all of these things that make what sort of should be relatively easy, much harder to do. And another big barrier is, you know, one of the things that happened when welfare reform was implemented in 1996 is that part of one of the regulations was that there would be a lifetime ban on SNAP and TANF, which is what we used to call welfare, for anybody who had been convicted of a drug felony. Not rape, not murder, all good. You can still get your benefits. Drug felony, which goes back to what Colleen was talking about earlier. We have race and poverty married. It is a sort of, it's a little bit of a dog whistle about racism, saying that somehow a drug felony should make it so you don't ever have access to support for food. You know, so those are some of the complications. Colleen, did I miss any?
Funding. All of those programs are drastically underfunded. You know, we know that programs like SNAP and WIC, which is a nutritional program for pregnant women and young children, they have all these great outcomes. People are healthier. People require fewer services. And they're always underfunded. The champions in Congress have to come in every year and beg for really crumbs from the table for these programs. We really don't consider them a good investment when they are proven to be a good investment. And that goes back to this flat out prejudice that we have against people in poverty and our belief that helping them in any way just encourages dependency.
And yeah, I read an op-ed in the Washington Post by this very, very wealthy couple who were Catholics. And they said, because we care so much about the poor, we want to stop these programs because we don't want to encourage them to be dependent. I cried. I was like, oh my God, they so don't get it, but they're living in their world of mansions and yachts, and they genuinely did care. And they genuinely believed the best thing to do was to make people stand strong on their own two feet.
You know, one thing that I'm sure Joanne has seen this, when you do direct service with people, people don't want to take any more than they need. Absolutely. You will have someone come into an emergency food pantry and you may say, we're giving out 4 boxes of pasta this week. And they'll say, it's just my husband and I, save it for somebody else. There's, you know, greed is really not something that happens
at the
bottom economic rung. It tends to crop up further up.
Well, and I think it's this mindset that's been planted and nurtured in people that it's dangerous to give poor people support because they'll get dependent on it and they won't work for it. And it's just so not what I've seen. It's not my experience. It's just, I don't think it's true, but it is something, it's a meme that's out there and it's a dominant meme.
Yeah.
It really is. And I think it is in large part what drives so much of the broken policy that we have. You know, the fact that SNAP is constantly being cut is an indication that, you know, how can anybody not think that food is the most important thing for people, right? I mean, I'm not a doctor, but everybody needs to eat every day. We all know that. And the fact that we would consider not feeding people sort of just says that we don't really care, because you can't function without food.
And so how do we change the mindset? Because that's the key. If we change that mindset, then we can change the policies. And part of why I'm excited about your book, and by the way, I want to show it to our listeners who are here, it's called Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. Great book. One of the reasons I'm excited about your book is that I think you're talking in very personal terms. You're telling the stories of what this is like, and you're showing how that mindset is wrong. And so I think maybe some of those stories could help undercut it. But what do you think? You've devoted a lot of time and effort to addressing and understanding and trying to eliminate poverty. What do you think is going to take to change that mindset?
Well, I mean, the thing I wanted to do when I was 6 years old, tell stories so that people would understand.
That's it?
That's what Joanne and I have done. Joanne marries that to giving people practical assistance and working in the policy world. I think that we need to keep coming out with this message again and again, because it really is countercultural. It's not what you hear. It's not what you see, but it is what's true. Mm-hmm. You know, when you read our book, we have mountains and mountains of statistics, and we have the stories of hundreds of people. This isn't some sort of, you know, whim that we had when we were out for a walk in the woods. This is really, really provable. And I would say that it even surprised us, people who have cared about us all their careers. Joanne and I would talk at night and say, I found this thing out today. This can't be true.
Mm-hmm.
And we dig and dig, and it was true. It was always true.
Fascinating.
And another thing that I think that was really important is that that's why we chose to interview people all over the country, because we felt like it was really important to not say, well, yeah, sure, it may be in New Haven, there's this problem. And this problem exists in every state in the country, and we wanted people to see that.
Right. And we have solutions. There's things we can do. And you talk in your book about saying it'd be very simple to fix the vast majority of homelessness. And I'm curious how.
With homes.
Build
right?
homes.
I mean, part of the problem is that we spend a lot of time trying to fix people who do not have homes, because we feel that there is something wrong with them. And we're certainly not saying that people who need mental health care or need substance abuse care shouldn't get it. But the presumption is that those are the issues that make you homeless. Most people become homeless because they cannot afford the rent, because there is no unit that they have access to that they can afford. So it's pretty simple. You know, you raise wages, you create more affordable housing. Simple doesn't mean easy, but it's not rocket science.
And that's really true across the board. You know, our solutions are very concrete, but what they include is giving people, you know, making the gap between how much money people have and how much money people need go away. So we can raise the wage, we can create some sort of universal basic income, we can increase the earned income tax credit. You know, there are all sorts of ways we can do it, but the only way to end poverty is to make sure people have enough money.
Exactly right. And I think that's a good way to talk about it. I'm writing a book right now, by the way, about creating an America that works for everyone. And I have a whole chapter that you're going to love. I know it's, you know, how do we create prosperity for all? And when I first started, it just kind of all the research and data I had was about, okay, we've got this massive wealth inequality. And then the more I got into it, it was like, really, we need to just be talking about people don't have enough money. That's the problem. If people had more money, then a lot of these problems would go away. Not every problem. As Joanne, you talked about, it's still hard to parent, even if you have financial resources and support. Parenting is just like the hardest job there is. But if you don't have money, it becomes really difficult hard to do it well. So I think we do need more money. And you talk about universal basic income. That, by the way, is something I lay out 12 12 actions we can take to get more people more money. And each one of them would help millions of people have more money, which is really what we want to do. But I am not a fan of the universal basic income. But I understand that it is the simplest way to say people need more money, give them more money. And in fact, it's what we're doing in the stimulus when we get that $1,600 check or $2,000 check, whatever it's going to be. That's just getting money into the hands of people. That then stimulates the economy. It's actually not only is it better for the people, it's better for our economy, because when people get money, they spend it. I mean, not the top 10%. I mean, you give them $2,000, it's not going to do anything different in the economy. But you get that $2,000 into the hand of the other 90% of America, and they're going to go out and they're going to buy food, they're going to buy cars, they're going to buy clothes, they're going to pay the rent to the landlord, who can then pay off their mortgage so they don't get foreclosed. It just has a really good ripple effect back up the chain. So have you, by the way, speaking of solutions, have you ever heard of Robert Friedman and his books about a few thousand dollars? He's actually, he was a guest on this program. He himself is an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune from San Francisco. And he got concerned about when he realized not everybody had all the advantages he had growing up. He dedicated his life to figuring out ways that people with less money could get more money. And he wrote them up in a fantastic book. His whole idea is in enabling people to create wealth in their lives. So, and this is where I kind of part company with you somewhat on the UBI universal basic income. I think it's, yes, we need it now in the crisis, and get people money so they can live in some measure of dignity throughout this crazy pandemic recession. But long-term, people need to be able to build wealth themselves, to have an education, get a good job, and maybe start a business, you know, whatever, to get a car so they can get to work, whatever the thing is. So I love that notion of enabling people to build wealth. And what do you think about that?
You're going to love baby bonds.
I love baby bonds.
We love
baby bonds. I'm a huge baby bond fan. And listeners, that's about when a baby is born, the government, you know, gives the baby a bond, some money, and it's put in, and then there's variations on it. But I like the one where every dollar that the family or friends put in for that baby gets an education. So I love baby bonds. I think it's a genius idea.
And I mean, I think that Joanne and I are not coming out for any one particular policy and saying, this is the magic bullet. What we're saying is the basic problem is the resource gap. And here are a bunch of things, and we review how they've worked in other places. And UBI has had some pretty good success, and really isn't an out there lefty idea. Milton Friedman thought it was a great idea, and so did Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
So I think it's worth exploring. I think a national jobs guarantee is worth exploring. I think that there are all sorts of things that we could do once we recognize that it is government's business to do it.
Yeah. And even the thing you mentioned earlier about companies, you know, raising the wages for workers, that's like an immediate thing. The minimum wage now federally is $7.25 an hour. Let's get it to 15 right away. And if a company can't afford to pay its workers $15 an hour, it shouldn't be in business. I mean, do a business where you're going to be able to pay people a decent kind of a wage. And I am really, it makes my blood boil when I think about companies like Amazon, which paid zero in federal taxes last year as multi-billionaire, like richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos. And he's paying a lot of his line workers very small wages to the point where they need then to apply for these programs that the government has for people who need food stamps or they need help paying their electricity and energy for to heat their homes. You know, why should the taxpayers be subsidizing workers for Amazon when it's a multi-billion dollar company with this wealthiest man in the world? So, but many, and I'm not to pick on Amazon, but many of these companies, McDonald's, they do the same thing. They pay so little wages.
We would actually say that we're not supporting the individuals. SNAP benefits are corporate benefits because so many people receiving them are working. So we're supporting those companies, not those people. And I think that that is also a part of the messaging that really has to change. If someone is working, nobody in America should be so poor that they can't eat. But anybody who is working full time, if they need public benefits, they're not being paid adequately. And that's just a fact, you know, but we're so accepting of the fact that, yeah, sure, lots of people need benefits. It's crazy.
Right, exactly. And I didn't see in there, you may have mentioned it, but unions, you know, for working people to have unions that fight mm-hmm. for them to have better wages, better working conditions. Unions are on a resurgence now. They're kind of on a decline. Absolutely. Now people are realizing like, oh my God, without a union, the boss can make you go work in that chicken factory, right, even if you've got COVID. And that's just not right. So I'm glad to see unions on the rise to help defend and improve the condition of working people. I mentioned before, wanted to circle back to what you said early on in the program about child poverty and that one in five children is poor and most poor people are white. And I don't know if you've seen this or looked in detail, the stimulus bill that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have put forward is awesome. There are so many great things in there. And people have been talking a lot about the $15 an hour minimum wage federally. So hopefully that stays in there. But if something that has not gotten hardly any coverage until today with Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, that there's a plan in the stimulus package now heading to Congress that could cut child poverty in half. And the way that they're going to do it is expanding the child tax credit, mm-hmm. $300 a month, up to $3,600 a year. And it is going to be paid monthly for the people who need it. And I'm just like, yes, this is exactly the kind of program. $300 a month. You might think that's not much, but that could change someone's life.
Absolutely. We are both so excited about that particular part of what he's suggesting. And so much of what the Biden-Harris administration in this short time has talked about, it's just so uplifting to hear them talk about child poverty and poverty in general as one of the most important things that they're going to focus on. It really does give me hope.
And needless to say, we should all be calling our members of Congress yes. and telling them that we feel that way.
Right, exactly. We need to have a show of support for the great work being done now with the Biden-Harris administration and the stimulus bill in particular. Like, let's do it. And some of these Republicans need to get on board. And I hope it's not just Democrats, but if it is, so it mm-hmm. is. We need to make it happen. Well, that's hopeful. And I had one small question, just because my husband works in public transit. I wanted to ask you, you talked about neglected transit systems make the poor vulnerable to other risks. What are they?
Well, there's health risks. If you're living in a community that's not well served by transit, you can't get to doctors and gyms and various places that you need to go. There's also a great risk of arrest on transit systems. A lot of poor people get arrested going to work and going to school on their transit systems. And there's also a big employment problem. We looked in some depth at New York City, where the subways to the outer boroughs are not nearly as well maintained as those in Midtown. The outer boroughs are where lower income workers live. They need to get into those inner boroughs to work. Many of them are healthcare workers themselves. And the transportation was so unreliable that they were actually missing shifts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you or I have problems getting to work one day, we can probably work remotely. We can probably make it up another time. If you punch a clock, you just don't get that pay.
Yeah. All good points. So how do people, like, is your book out now, Broken America, if people want to get it? Is that available now in bookstores or?
It is available anywhere you buy books, and we would love for people to go out and get that.
Yeah, and I hope you get on Stephen Colbert's show and talk about that.
We're trying. If you have any connections, feel free to, you know, let us
but
know.
We consider talking to you on or not.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, I think it's a good beginning, and I hope you get out there more, and I hope people hear your message, you know, and particularly anything you can do to help get beyond the mindset that poor people are lazy and not working. But there's a lot of people suffering economically. Most people in America now are suffering economically. There's a lot we can and should do about it. There are proven programs that are effective about it. As you say, the main thing is close the gap between the money that they have and the money that they need, increase wages, increase programs, baby bonds, whatever we can do, the stimulus thing. And I'm excited about this child tax credit. Mm-hmm. There's a lot we can do. Some of it's in your book. And the most important contribution I think you're going to make is to humanize the face of people who are struggling economically and to break that lock of the mindset. And that really, people without a lot of resources are among the most resilient, hardworking, resourceful people in our country. And we need everybody. We need everybody to get the economy going. We need everyone to deal with the climate crisis. We need everyone to help get through this pandemic. We don't have a person to waste. So I am so grateful for the book you wrote, and I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you so much for the time.
And that is all the time we have. Joanne Goldblum and Colleen Shattuck, authors of Broken America, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us. Have a great day.